This episode is provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenes, based on the most relevant LinkedIn posts about MarTech from calendar weeks 16 and 17. Frenes is a B2B market research company that supports enterprise marketing teams in unlocking the full potential of their customer data with the help of AI. You can find more info in the description.
So to kick things off, I want you to picture something.
Okay, go for it.
Imagine dropping like $5,000 on this high-end, super advanced smart fridge because your food just keeps spoiling, right?
Right.
But you live in a house where the electrical wiring is literally held together by duct tape. And to make it worse, you haven't even bothered to plug in the oven that you bought last year.
I mean, you would just call that completely irrational. Like, why would anyone do that?
Exactly. But in B2B MarTech right now, I mean, that is pretty much exactly what marketing leaders are doing every single day.
Yeah. Which is why we're seeing this massive industry-wide reality check. Huh. And that's exactly what we're getting into today. We are stepping away from the, you know, the perfectly polished strategy slide decks to look at the actual state of B2B marketing technology.
Because honestly, the era of endless stack expansion it's effectively dead. The new mandate across the board is execution discipline.
Totally. So if you are a B2B marketing professional trying to navigate this space, we promise you a really focused, no-fluff deep dive into what is actually working right now.
Yeah, we tracked the top trends across LinkedIn during calendar week 16 and 17, and we're looking way past the hype of just acquiring shiny new tools.
Right. We want to unpack how teams are actually achieving operational excellence. Mm. And the overarching theme we found in the data is this really painful but completely necessary pivot.
Yeah, Dan McGaugh pointed out this wild pattern he's seen. He's worked with over, I think, 500 companies, and he says the cycle is almost always identical.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. It's so predictable.
It really is. A company goes out, they buy a customer data platform, they fail to connect it to their ad networks, and then they buy an analytics tool that literally nobody logs into.
Right. Nobody checks it.
Never. And then invariably, like 6 months later, someone sits in a strategy meeting and claims they need to buy yet another tool to fix their pipeline problem.
It's just wild. And the tragic part is that companies routinely try to, you know, buy their way out of this massive data mess.
Yeah, they just throw money at it.
Exactly. There was this fantastic example shared by Nick Friedman to Bockhorst that, honestly, it should make every marketing leader listening to this just wince.
Oh, the attribution platform story.
Yes.
Yeah.
He talked about a client who was literally days away from signing a $100,000 contract for a brand new attribution platform.
$100,000, just casually.
Right. But when they finally sat down and actually mapped out their existing infrastructure, they realized they already owned three different tools capable of doing attribution.
Three tools, sitting completely idle.
Yeah. So the fix for their pipeline visibility was not some shiny new purchase order. It was literally just 2 weeks of dedicated integration work.
But, you know, because no one was actually maintaining the connections between the systems they'd already paid for, the data broke down. And when the data breaks down, the sales team immediately loses trust in the reporting.
Yep. And then the panic reflex kicks in and they just throw more software at the problem.
Which is the worst thing you can do, because every new tool you add without proper integration just creates more complexity. And complexity is what ultimately kills your execution speed.
We see how damaging this fragmented data is, especially mm-hmm. in highly complex environments. Alex Mambrillo highlighted this specific nightmare in healthcare marketing.
Oh, yeah. Healthcare is a perfect example for this.
It really is. Because healthcare groups frequently grow through mergers and acquisitions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a single marketing team might inherit like six different CRMs.
Oh, six.
Six CRMs, a dozen isolated call tracking systems, and just massive, messy overlaps in patient data.
I mean, reporting in that kind of environment just turns into a manual 40-hour-a-week administrative black hole.
Exactly. Mambrillo's advice cuts straight to the core here. He says you absolutely must define a single source of truth and consolidate your data before you even entertain the idea of customizing workflows or buying specialized add-ons.
Right, which brings up the real technical challenge for the people actually managing these systems day to day. Atish Narlawar noted that the hardest engineering work in MarTech today is no longer evaluating and selecting vendors.
Right. Anyone can buy software.
Exactly. The hardest work now is the glue.
The glue. I love that term for it.
Yeah, the glue is the critical piece. And we aren't talking about, you know, fragile duct tape connections using basic Zapier triggers that just break the second someone changes a field name.
Oh, I've lived through that nightmare.
We all have. We are talking about building robust data pipelines and API connections that allow these platforms platforms to communicate bidirectionally in real time without any human intervention.
But going back to that fridge analogy, if your entire house is wired poorly, applying stronger glue isn't going to fix the structural issue, right?
No, not at all.
And this is exactly why the entire philosophy of MarTech architecture is shifting right now. If the core problem is a bunch of fragmented tools acting like isolated silos, the industry solution is moving towards something called composable architecture.
Right. And Steve Chitwood introduced a brilliant concept to frame this shift. He calls it the ambition gap.
The ambition gap. Okay, break that down for me.
So the ambition gap is the massive distance between the fancy strategy deck your CMO presented to the board, you know, the one promising real-time, omni-channel, AI-driven personalization.
Oh, yeah, the buzzword deck.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The gap between that deck and what your systems can actually execute on a random Tuesday.
Because on a random Tuesday, most teams are what, like manually uploading batch CSV files?
Yeah, exactly. They're dealing with fragmented user identities, writing channel-specific rules in Marketo that have absolutely no idea what is happening over in Salesforce.
It's all completely disconnected.
Right. So Chitwood argues that your underlying architecture is your actual revenue infrastructure. It sets the absolute ceiling on your growth.
So the architecture you have dictates the strategy you can execute, not the other way around.
100%.
So to physically close that ambition gap, we really have to look at how these systems are built.
Yeah.
Josh Kanagi provided a really clear mental model for this in the posts we reviewed.
Yeah, I love his take on this.
He says you have to architect your stack from the data core outward. Let's break down how this actually functions compared to the old way. Historically, a tool like, say, your email platform, it was a monolith.
Right. It did everything.
Yeah, it held the customer data. It made all the decisions about who gets what email, and then it sent the email.
But in the new composable model, that completely flips. Your intelligence layer, which includes, you know, identity resolution, audience building, all the decisioning logic that is pulled entirely out of the individual tools.
So where does it go?
That brain now lives centrally in your data warehouse.
Meaning your engagement tools, whether that is your email platform, your SMS gateway, your ad network, they're treated merely as dumb receivers.
Dumb receivers, exactly. They don't do any of the thinking anymore.
So the data warehouse runs a query, decides that, you know, user X needs to see message Y, and it just sends a simple API instruction to the email tool saying, hey, send this specific template right now.
And Katie Ewan backed up why this structure is just so vital. She emphasized that real-time behavioral infrastructure is the only thing that makes this composable canvas work.
Right.
Because when a user clicks a link in an email, that action doesn't just sit trapped in the email platform's reporting dashboard. It feeds back into the central data core continuously, instantly updating the user's profile.
So then the ad platform can immediately adjust its retargeting bid based on that email click.
Exactly. It's all connected in real time. Bindi S. Raj also noted that this API-first modular approach completely outmaneuvers those old monolithic stacks when it comes to business agility.
But, I mean, pulling the intelligence out of the engagement interface and putting it into a data warehouse, that creates a massive human problem, doesn't it?
How so?
Well, if I am an ops manager who spent the last 5 years mastering the intricacies of a very specific email marketing interface, I am suddenly playing in the wrong sandbox.
Yeah. That is a tough pill to swallow.
So let me ask the uncomfortable question here.
Oh.
If engagement tools are just receivers now, does this mean marketers need to stop obsessing over the UI of their delivery platforms and focus almost entirely on their data infrastructure?
Honestly, that is the harsh reality the industry is waking up to right now.
Yes.
If your intelligence lives in your central data core, the user interface of the delivery tool matters significantly less than its API capabilities.
Wow.
Yeah. The companies that win in this next era won't be the ones with the deepest, most complex implementation of a single engagement product. The winners are going to be the ones whose data foundation is so incredibly strong that every engagement product becomes completely interchangeable.
So if a vendor raises their prices, you just, what, unplug their API and plug in a competitor?
Exactly. And your central brain doesn't skip a beat.
That is fascinating. But
yeah,
you definitely cannot run this new composable data-first architecture with a legacy operating model, which is driving this massive reframing of how we view marketing operations talent.
Yeah, Ronald Gaines brought up a really transformative concept here. He says, we need to start treating marketing ops systems as products.
Not just projects.
Right. We have to stop treating internal systems as temporary projects or just like simple task lists.
So mechanically, what does that actually look like for a team?
It means applying actual product management principles to your internal tools. If you build a lead routing workflow, you don't just launch it and walk away and forget about it.
Right.
You treat it as the lead lifecycle engine. You define who its internal users are, you establish a product roadmap for feature updates, and you track specific outcomes and KPIs.
So when ops shifts from just, you know, taking support tickets and executing tactics to actively defining value through system capabilities, they become an indispensable part of the revenue engine.
Exactly. But that level of rigor is pretty much the exact opposite of how most companies currently run.
Yeah, Matthew Vollm delivered a pretty harsh reality check regarding revenue operations on LinkedIn. He stated that most companies don't actually have governed execution.
Right. They just have, what did he call it?
He said they have postmortem ops and vibes.
Vibes. That is hilarious, describing an operating model as vibes.
It's funny, but deeply tragic for the bottom line, honestly.
Definitely. Because what he means is that if your audit trail for a discount approval lives in some random Slack thread, or if your sales reps have figured out how to manually bypass mandatory CRM fields just to push a deal through.
Which they always do.
Always. Then you don't actually have governance. You just have an illusion of control. And that gap between what the system demands and what actually happens on the floor is where your revenue and your data trust leak right out of the business.
And the cost of that lack of governance is incredibly high, especially for the new talent you bring in to fix it.
Oh.
Evan Kubicek warned about this. He calls it the invisible tax of undocumented systems.
Oh, the Indiana Jones story.
Yes. He shared a story about a newly hired marketing director who spent her entire first 30 days playing Indiana Jones, just doing digital archaeology.
Doing archaeology instead of actually building.
Exactly. She was forced to reverse engineer why certain workflows were built 3 years ago. She was discovering that critical automations were firing off the completely wrong fields because the person who built them left zero documentation.
See, documentation isn't just some nice-to-have administrative chore. It is the foundational infrastructure that dictates whether your next expensive hire actually builds anything valuable, or if they just spend their first 6 months excavating a broken database.
Right. And all of this friction is clearing the way for a brand new role that we are seeing debated all over LinkedIn right now. The marketing engineer.
Yes, the marketing engineer.
Yeah.
Both Jason K. Walsh and Nick Lafferty really explored this evolution.
Yeah, so define what that is for us.
So this is a marketer who builds systems, deploys AI agents, and writes complex automations at the architectural level.
Okay, but I want to push back on this a little bit.
Sure.
Is marketing engineer really a new thing, or is it just a fancy inflated title upgrade for a senior marketing ops manager?
I mean, it is a fair pushback.
Yeah.
But Nick Lafferty makes a really critical distinction between the two roles. Marketing operations is your bedrock foundation.
Okay.
Ops ensures clean data hygiene, functional integrations, reliable processes. Basically, they keep the lights on and the infrastructure running. A marketing engineer, however, takes that clean foundation and builds entirely new capabilities on top of it.
Oh, I see. So they are the ones writing like custom Python scripts to connect an AI decisioning engine directly to the ad bidding API.
Precisely. They combine a really deep understanding of marketing strategy with heavy technical fluency.
Mm.
So they don't just maintain the CRM, they invent new programmatic ways to go to market that a standard out-of-the-box tool could literally never accomplish.
And that technical fluency is mandatory today. Because once you have the right data architecture and the engineering talent to govern it, you can finally deploy AI effectively.
Right.
To go back to our earlier kitchen analogy, deploying an AI agent is kind of like hiring a personal chef.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't just throw random disconnected tasks at a new human team member and expect them to drive strategy.
Yeah, if your smart fridge is still unplugged and your pantry is a disorganized mess, that chef is just going to stand there completely confused.
Exactly. You give them a defined role and integrate them into a shared workflow. You got to build the architecture first.
And once that architecture is in place, the conversation around AI in MarTech moves rapidly away from just basic prompt engineering.
Yeah, Ian Kim introduced a fantastic framework for this. He says we need to design agentic marketing around durable AI roles rather than just short-lived tactical use cases.
Meaning if you just use AI for tactical things like asking it to generate three subject lines for this one email, the efficiency gains just don't scale.
Right. But if you assign an AI agent the structural role of, say, a data analyst, and its permanent job is to constantly identify engagement patterns across all your channels and alert you to anomalies well, then you create a real collaborative operational model.
And Aquabarraman highlighted a mechanism that makes this team-wide collaboration actually function using a feature called Claude Skills.
Oh, I was reading about that. So instead of fragmented prompting, right?
Exactly. Currently, the typical marketing team uses AI in these isolated silos. Five different marketers write five different prompts to write a blog post, and you end up with five wildly inconsistent brand voices.
Which is a nightmare for brand consistency.
Right. But Claude Skills changes that mechanism entirely. It acts as a central repository, almost like a master CSS file for a website, so that marketing engineer we just talked about can build a single, highly optimized, shared workflow for the whole team.
Wow. So if they update the core prompt to reflect a new brand guideline, everyone's AI output across the entire department updates instantly.
Yes. Without the individual marketers having to change their behavior at all.
That is huge. But introducing centralized AI workflows requires really careful management. Tim Moeller brought up the concept of dividing your operations into the lab versus the factory.
The lab and the factory. I really like this framework.
Me too. The lab is where you conduct your fast-paced, AI-enabled experiments. But the factory is where your proven, scalable, governed revenue operations run.
And his warning here is critical for anyone deploying AI. The lab requires strict engineering discipline. You have to time box your AI experiments and define really clear exit criteria.
Right. So if an AI agent isn't producing reliable results within, say, a 2-week sprint, you shut it down.
You have to. If you don't contain those experiments, that indefinite tinkering just bleeds into your production environment and your factory completely grinds to a halt.
And the major platform vendors are absolutely recognizing this shift and completely redesigning their underlying systems.
Yeah, Akande Davis and Katja Keesum both shared some really profound observations from the Adobe Summit regarding Project Halo and Marketo.
They noted that platforms are being rebuilt from the ground up to be native agent-first environments.
And we aren't talking about a generic AI chatbot just bolted onto a settings menu somewhere.
No, not at all. These native agents are designed to take a messy, unstructured text brief from a product manager, automatically turn it into a multi-channel campaign plan, build the actual assets, and then QA the entire program against complex organizational rules before a human ever even clicks approve.
It is a fundamental rethinking of how marketing operations work gets executed inside a platform.
But, you know, when you combine composable stacks, marketing engineers, and native AI agents driving incredibly complex multi-touch campaigns at scale, the old ways we measure success completely fracture under the pressure.
Oh, entirely. The attribution models we've relied on for the last decades simply do not map to this new reality.
Bill Habib made a really poignant observation about this disconnect. He noted that while the MQL, the marketing qualified lead, isn't strictly dead, absolutely no one trusts it as a leading indicator of revenue anymore.
Right. When Habib asked a room full of marketing leaders if they still report MQLs to their executive teams, almost everyone raised their hand.
Naturally.
But then when he asked if they actually trust those MQLs to predict future revenue, the hands just vanished.
Wow.
Yeah. The unit of measurement has to evolve from the individual lead to the account level. One person downloading a white paper is just an activity metric.
Right. It doesn't mean they're buying.
Exactly. But three different stakeholders from the same target company engaging across a podcast, an ad, and an email sequence over 2 weeks now, that is a quantifiable buying group forming.
Petra Marino provided a really necessary reality check on why capturing that group behavior is so difficult, though. B2B measurement is just inherently messy.
Very messy.
Sales cycles stretch for 18 months. Buying committees consist of like 10 different people rotating in and out of the process.
Yeah.
Trying to assign a precise fractional dollar value to every single marketing touchpoint in a dashboard is virtually impossible.
Which leads to a highly controversial but honestly necessary take from Pranav Piyush. He argued that we need to stop chasing perfect attribution dashboards altogether.
Just abandon them.
Pretty much. He pointed out the mechanical reality of digital tracking today. Between browser privacy updates, ad blockers, cookie deprecation, digital tracking only captures about 20% of the real nonlinear human journey.
20%? That is nothing.
Right. So the other 80% happens in dark social. It happens in private Slack communities, offline conversations, text messages between colleagues, and untrackable browser sessions.
So if you only optimize for the 20% you can actually see, you are effectively starving your most effective marketing channels.
Exactly. Piyush's advice is to start waiting for perfect tracking data. Instead, run bold experiments with strong hypotheses to actively create the data you need to prove your business impact.
But let's pause and consider the actual friction point here for a second.
Yeah.
If you are a marketing leader preparing for a board meeting next Tuesday, and you admit to your CEO that your attribution dashboard misses 80% of the buyer journey, and you're completely abandoning the comfort of the MQOL metric, how does a marketing leader actually defend a multi-million dollar marketing budget in that boardroom?
I mean, that is the single most important question for a marketing leader today. And you defend it with what Habib called confidence in pipeline value. You have to stop talking about top-of-funnel activity metrics entirely and start talking strictly about movement toward revenue.
So aligning with sales.
Deeply aligning with sales. You defend the budget by focusing on credible account-level signals that demonstrably result in accepted opportunities. You show the board-controlled experiments that prove how marketing materially accelerated deal velocity or increased average contract value.
It is a significantly higher bar to clear than just reporting, hey, we got 500 new leads. But it is a much more honest reflection of marketing's true impact on the business.
Absolutely.
Well, to wrap up this deep dive, there is a final forward-looking insight from the sources that perfectly bridges everything we have covered today, from composable architecture to real-time data cores to directly impacting revenue.
Yeah, Emil Bjørnskjær provided a brilliant analysis of the payment infrastructure company Adyen acquiring Talon, one which is a real-time promotion and loyalty engine.
Right, because historically, loyalty programs and promotion logic have lived squarely inside the MarTech stack. They sit in your CRM or your campaign manager, calculating points, sending out discount codes via email, way upstream from where the money actually changes hands.
But look at the mechanism of this acquisition. It signals that loyalty and promotions are moving directly into the real-time transaction architecture.
So if an AI agent decides a customer is a flight risk, it doesn't just, you know, send them an email coupon for their next visit.
No, the system calculates a personalized margin discount in milliseconds and applies it dynamically at the exact moment the customer swipes their credit card at the checkout layer.
Which leaves us with a highly provocative thought for you to mull over. As these systems become infinitely faster and fully composable, the traditional boundaries between MarTech, FinTech, and sales are permanently blurring.
We are rapidly moving toward one unified commercial decisioning layer across the entire enterprise.
So the question you have to ask yourself is this: are your data foundations strong enough to support an AI agent making a real-time margin-impacting decision during a live transaction?
Because if your data is still sitting in disconnected silos, just waiting for a duct-taped Zapier integration to fire an update to your CRM, you are going to be too late.
Before you go out and buy another high-end smart fridge, make sure your house actually has the wiring to plug it in. If you enjoyed this episode, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on account-based marketing, field marketing, channel marketing, AI and B2B marketing, go-to-market, and social selling.
Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive into the reality of MarTech. Don't forget to hit subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.